the Q ratio, average convergence, divergence, basis points, and BS. Financial shows love to sound smart, but on Money Matters, we want to make you smart. That's why the goal is to keep you informed and empowered. Our focus, providing clear, actionable information without the financial jargon to help 1 million families retire sooner and happier. Based on the long-running WSB radio show, this Money Matters podcast is tailor-made for both modern retirees and those still in the planning stages. Join us in this exciting new chapter, and let's journey toward a financially secure and joyful retirement together. Welcome back to Money Matters. Your host, Wes Moss here, along with co-host today, Jeff Lloyd, with two L's and no re. Or do you go by Jeffrey or Jeffrey Lloyd? Or
Jeffrey Jeff? Is my real name, but I go by Jeff. And thank you for having me back.
I was inspired this week. I got a listener email that was pretty nice, saying that it's one of the few places he feels like he actually learned something. So I'm going to double down on hoping we learn something today here on Money Matters.
That's reassuring to hear. Here on Money Matters, we like to have fun, but at the end of the day, we want to educate our listeners on financial markets and preparing for retirement. That's what we do on Money Matters.
And what's happening in the world, right? We have tensions in the Middle East. We have the market and the market and the media totally obsessed with the Federal Reserve. I mean, they're salivating over every single word that the Federal Reserve is saying or might say or about to say or parsing. And I think that's a really, really important theme for the last couple of months, and it continues to boil even hotter. It's almost at a fevered pitch, and this market's obsession with, I almost think of it as like mommy and daddy Fed. It's the parenting style of the Federal Reserve, and it just, the parents are home, and they're cracking down. There's no more candy bowl. It's all spinach. It's all you're grounded, and the world just wants to mom and dad to go away on another trip so we can stop eating spinach. And we can go back to the candy bowl whenever we want. That's just not happening. But I think that's part of this obsession. By the way, my second grader wanted to make, he was so excited to make a shake. So none of my other kids seem to, I've had four of them. The three my older boys, they don't care about cooking. I mean, they don't fit into the grill master theme that we love here on Money Matters. You and I love to grill.
Is he making like a protein shake? Is he starting to work out in second grade? Is that where youth athletics is going these days? It's like a workout routine starting in second grade?
Speaking of one of our podcast guests, Dr. John Deloney, he's on Ramsey. He's one of Ramsey's guys. I saw a clip this week that, and we interviewed him for the podcast, the Retire Sooner podcast. I don't even know if that's aired yet, but it will soon. He said that youth sports, travel sports, are ruining the American family. And I stopped to rewatch it, He makes such an amazing point. You're a victim of it. I'm a victim of it. Maybe it's good in the long run, probably not good in the long run, but we're totally off topic. I want to get back to the Fed. By the way, Johnson & Johnson, they just raised their dividend for how many years, Jeff Lloyd?
Their 62nd consecutive year of increasing their dividend. 62 years in a row.
By the way, and we're going to be talking about some exchange-traded funds, ETFs, here on the show today. And I always want to couch this. It's when you're doing financial radio and you're doing it to a large audience, we don't know who's listening. I don't know your particular situation. I don't know your risk tolerance. I don't know the stage you're in, whether you're 30 and an aggressive investor, or you're 65 and you're just fine, or you just want to own fixed income and bonds. So when we talk about individual ETFs, and we'll talk about some of these companies inside these ETFs that are also dividend raisers over time, they're really for educational purposes. What you might want and look for may be different from someone else. So maybe this fits your profile, maybe it doesn't. But I think it's just important to at least bring these up so people can go look, do your own research, and maybe it works for you, maybe it doesn't. So we're going to talk about these things in an educational context. These are not recommendations for people necessarily to do. Where do we start, Jeff Lloyd? How about this? This one got me. And again, I learned this from a podcast guest this past week on a recording. Over the last decade or more than a decade, we keep track of, I call them scary retirement statistics. And really what they are is just the state of play when it comes to retirement in America. And I found for the first time a website that does an amazing job at this, where you can go in and it's Federal Reserve data. And it's actually, the website is usafacts.org. And these are, it's all different ways to look at how much people have saved in the United States. Retirement savings, how much people have in their checking account, different age categories. And if you go and look at this, here's one that I found. This is households with more than $100,000 saved for retirement by age. It's an interactive chart, easy to use. So I went in there and I looked at how many people have more than 100K saved for retirement. Well, it's not necessarily for retirement, but you can go look at it per age. So we look at the 65 to 69-year-old. That's arguably retirement age. And the answer is this. Only 31% of Americans that are in that age range, 65 through 69, have $100,000 or more saved for retirement. Now, look at it another way. That means that nearly 70% of Americans that are 65 through 69 have less than $100,000 saved. More than nearly 70% of Americans have less than 100 grand. So we have there is this thought that we have somewhat of a retirement crisis in the United States, and that's it. I don't know what other statistic tells it, but if you're going into retirement and you have less than 100K saved, there's really very little income generation off of that. So you're pretty much relying on Social Security. Maybe some of these folks, though, have pensions. And I've seen this where if you've got a really good pension program and you know it over the course of 30 years, it's not that uncommon for that group to save a little less because they know they're going to have a whole lot of pension. So it doesn't tell the full story, but very telling in its own right.
Also on Money Matters, a lot of the topics that we discuss is how to enjoy a happy retirement. And one of the things that we talk about is the median net worth that someone needs to have in order to have a happy retirement. $100,000 sounds like a lot of money, but for retirement, that level is not setting someone up for necessarily a happy retirement.
Here's another one. Number of people without any savings, 39%, 39.2% of American adults have nada retirement savings whatsoever. Here's another statistic that's concerning about the state of play here. This is about low confidence in retirement security. Only 31% of non-retirees believe their retirement savings is on track. That's a drop from 40% a couple years ago. And 71% of non-retired adults report a moderate worry that the retirement savings just isn't enough.
Do you think
42% very worried?
Do you think a rise in inflation has anything to do with the drop in confidence?
Ooh, that's a very good point. It is. It's got to be a big part of it. Another, I think that this is, and here's where there's more worry. Inflation comes into play. We know higher prices are sticking around. We call it cotton candy like inflation, meaning that the inflation numbers over the last couple of weeks have come in. The headlines are the inflation's hotter than expected. It's not much. Inflation was expected to be 3.4%. In the last CPI report, consumer price index inflation report, came in at 3.5. So it's not as though inflation is jumping through the roof again like we saw two summers ago. However, it's a little warmer than expected, and it's hanging around, it's sticking around, hence kind of like cotton candy, which looks good on the surface until 5 minutes in, it's warm and it sticks to it, just won't go away. That's exactly the state of play. And that in itself is what the marketplace seems to be so obsessed about. So if you think about the news around the world and what investors have become, I think, almost completely obsessed with is the Fed's next move. What is Jerome Powell going to do?
I actually thought about this on the
draft. They should put him on the cover of a cereal box. Like, he's like the most popular guy in America. Even though the Olympics is coming up in less than 100 days, it's like Jerome Powell on the box of Wheaties.
Put him on the Wheaties box.
Put him on Wheaties.
But I was thinking about this on the drive in this morning. Obviously, We heard some comments from Powell this week, and I was thinking, does the market react more to anything that Jerome Powell says more than, let's say, the State of the Union? We heard the State of the Union about a month ago. Do investors and people want to hear from Powell more?
100% more.
I think so too.
10 times more. What we're seeing, though, is that the care around the market, what's the market's hanging on every word. If it looks like rates are going to go up, stock market goes down. If interest rates do tick up a little bit, because Jerome Powell said, I'm going to calm down on interest rates and we may not cut like we expect, like you all expected, then interest rates shoot higher. Markets don't do all that well. So it's understandable that there is this craving for information out of the Fed. We went so long with what I would consider easy parenting. We had zero, and I had to pull up a chart of the federal funds rate and take a look at where we've come from. We had 0% interest rates from December of 2008 until October of 2015. Think about how long that is. That's 7 years. 7 years of what I would consider, like, mom and dad are on vacation. They left you out. They're on vacation. You got no rules. Easy parenting. Candy bowl free and open. You didn't have to eat any veggies, no spinach whatsoever. Oh, by the way, we totally skipped over the story about the protein shake.
Okay. We did.
So
the second grader's making a shake.
I'm going to get back to easy parenting. So my second grader, he's all in on wanting to do one of these shakes. So I said, look, the best way to make one of these healthy shakes in the morning, you've got to get ripe bananas, you got to put them in Ziploc, you got to freeze them. That's your base. That's your base for a good shake. So we did that. He was excited to do it. And then the next morning, we made the shake. We put in the bananas. We put in the green spinach or whatever and some peanut butter, some vanilla, right, healthy shake. And he was like, great. Well, I enjoy, Dad. Enjoy. So I thought you wanted to make the shake. He goes, no, it looks disgusting. He's like, I don't even like bananas, let alone spinach with bananas. So he really just wanted to make it for fun. I thought he was excited about drinking this shake for the morning, and he literally just wanted to do it. So I was stuck with a giant thing of
I didn't the see green the story monster. Going that way. I really didn't. Caught me for a loop.
Well, me too. I was, what are we doing? I thought that we were drinking the green monster. No, I don't even like bananas. Anyway, sorry. I think I want to wrap this quickly and help people understand what I mean by the parenting analogy going back to the Fed. When rates are low, it's easy. Think about low rates, mortgage rates are at 2%. That's easy. You can go buy a house, your payments are low, the economy is stimulated. When rates are high, it is much more taxing on the economy. You've got a wet blanket on top. So we went through this period of time, 08 through 2015, 7 years of zero rates, easy parenting, candy bowl out, free and open. No one in the house had to eat their spinach or their veggies. Then mom and dad came back home, at least for a little bit, and enforced some rules. This is the Fed coming back and made us eat a little bit of spinach. So December of 15 through right until COVID hit, 2020, rates went back up. Still not all that high, but at least there were some interest rates as opposed to zero. Then after COVID hit, the Fed immediately went back to zero rates. Money was virtually free. We had negative interest rates in a lot of places around the world. And so back to all candy. It's candy bowls out. Mom and dad back to zero parenting. And that lasted for about 2 years. All of 2020 and 2021, we went back to zero parenting, zero rates. All candy again, no parenting, zero rates, easy money. Then, and this is where we are today, this is the result. Then January 2022, mom and dad came back. And due to all the largesse and the inflation, they came home. House was a mess. And they got more strict than ever. And they got strict overnight. And they started raising rates. Spinach, eat your spinach. No candy, no fun. Rates up and up and up and up. And then in September 2023, they at least stopped upping the punishment for the economy, and they stopped upping rates. And we've been in this holding pattern now for what, 250, 260 some days. All everyone wants to know is, when are mom and dad just going to take it easy again? When are they going to go away? Mom, when and dad, when are you going to go back on vacation. Can't they just lower rates? And Jerome Powell was on 60 Minutes in, call it, I think early, it was early Feb. And it's amazing what he said versus what the market heard. He vowed that he will, so this is a direct quote here. This was like a Sunday night, you know, 60 Minutes, tick, 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 tick. It's that anxiety provoking. As soon as you hear it, you're watching football. And then, well, not this time of year, but all of a sudden then you get the tick, 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 tick. And it brings up this, what's 60 Minutes going to say? Central bank will proceed. This is his quote. The central bank, he vowed in an interview that the central bank will proceed carefully with interest rate cuts this year. He said proceed carefully, but here's what the market heard. Jerome Powell vowed that he will proceed with interest rate cuts this year. What they didn't hear, or what the market didn't want to hear, is that Jerome Powell would proceed carefully with interest rate cuts. He didn't say he was going to do them anytime too soon. The market said, oh, wait, mom and dad are going back on vacation. Maybe they're going to ease things up a little bit. A little more candy, a little less spinach, and it still hasn't happened. That's why the market is obsessed and hanging on every single word. Couple builds $15 million home in Sag Harbor, then sells when dog doesn't like it. That's a real story in the Wall Street Journal. It was fascinating.
Who was running that household?
Who
was in charge?
They bought the land.
Who was the top dog? So, by the way, is what I want to know. Who's the top dog?
Sag Harbor. I had to look this up. Sag Harbor is the Hamptons, and I went to Google Maps, and Sag Harbor, at least from what I can tell or remember, looks like the northern end of the island, and then you've got the southern end, and maybe they call it the west and the east. So it's East Hampton is more on the Atlantic, and Sag Harbor is more on the harbor. This couple bought the land for a steal. It was something like $3 million. Then they built this, renovated/built this incredible home, right? It's one of these houses that you look at. And of course, the kitchen is the best kitchen you've ever seen. And for some reason, every kitchen photo that's in any sort of real estate thing, and this was in the real estate section of the Wall Street Journal, what is it filled with, Jeff Lloyd, besides fancy French stoves? What's always in the kitchen to make it look amazing?
Windows? Big windows?
Good windows. That's part of it. Copper pots hanging from somewhere, right? They're either hanging over the island, the copper pots that you and I don't have. No one has them except for the people in the pictures. Or they're hanging over the stove, and there's lots of copper pots and pans, and they just make everything look amazing. I even showed, this week I showed Lynn, I said, look at this kitchen. And you know, she goes, I hate all those copper pots. But I think they make the photo, and there's always lemons in a bowl, maybe kitchens don't ever really look like that. Here's the reality. They built this house. They spent a couple years building, and probably, I don't know, $10 million. They're selling it now for almost $15 million, $14.95. Because their dog, Rufus, once they moved in, seemed a little down.
Pouty. They used the phrase pouty. The dog was pouty, which is real. That's an emotion you can sense from your dogs.
What's behind all of that? And again, look, I get it. They love their dog. They love Rufus. He didn't like the beaches at Sag Harbor because they were in California. Beaches were sandy. They figured it out because Rufus didn't like the Sag Harbor beaches, which, again, I had to Google this. I had to use ChatGPT to figure out. Wasn't totally clear. They're on more of a rocky beach, pebbly. So he couldn't dig or run as fast as when they went back to East Hampton, where the beaches are more like the normal Atlantic and it's normal sand. And he could run and he was happy again. He goes back to Sag Harbor, back to Powelton. We're out of here. We're selling.
I could see where the rocky beach would be a little tough on the paws, on the dog paws, yeah. Right?
He's a red golden doodle, and it's time to go.
Well, what's our theme here with Fed Powell and a lot of talk of paws, both with the dog and what the Fed's doing right now? So
it sounds like interest rates need to go even higher if that's the case. If we're still just popping around houses because
if the dog doesn't
love it, let's just get up and move. Anyway, I did get a good education using Google Earth on what the Hamptons were and the Sag Harbor. And Anyway, I'm going to get some copper pots for the kitchen. So here, I'm going to go back to this analogy around the Fed and maybe bring this all a little tighter, is that if you go back and look at the federal funds rate, the target rate, producer Mallory asked me, she keeps saying zero. She asked, hey, you're saying zero rate. You're saying zero interest rates. She goes, what do you mean? What do you mean zero? What I mean by that is that interest rates, the Federal Reserve literally took them down to zero. Their target rate was zero. And that's why everything else came lower and lower and lower. The 10-year treasury was at some point was under two. It was in the 1% range. Mortgage rates are set by that 10-year rate. So that's when you got the 2 and 2.5% refinance rates. That's why 80% of Americans have really low interest rates, because we had a period of time where rates were, it was called ZIRP, which is stands for zero interest rate policy. When rates are at 5, 5.5, it's hard to even remember back that they were, hey, what do you mean? Wait, they were at zero? Yeah, the Fed funds rate that sets everything went down to literally at zero. And that's why rates were so low for a while. And that's what we call, that's what I mean by easy parenting. We got used to just all candy, no spinach, easy, low rates where it makes everything more affordable. Easy to get a mortgage at 3.5%, makes your payment really low. And that lasted for 7 years. That was 2008 all the way to 2015. Then we had a little spike in rates, still weren't all that high. And then COVID hit, we went back down to zero interest rates, the Fed setting rates at zero. And then they because we got all this inflation from money dumped onto the system and the supply chain bottlenecks because of COVID, prices went up. We had 9% inflation, and the Federal Reserve said, "Wait a minute, we got to do something to slow everything down, to slow inflation." So mom and dad came back home and started implementing. Hey, we're eating spinach, not candy. You guys are all grounded, and that's kind of what happened. The economic environment got much stricter, and it got more and more and more strict. Fed raised rates 11, 12 times, and now they've stayed put. And everyone's kind of waiting for things to get easier again. And Powell came on 60 Minutes in February and said, we're thinking about or we're considering interest rate cuts. We're going to be careful about it. But instead, the whole marketplace heard, oh, they're cutting rates. And the expectations after that meeting or after his rare interview on tick, 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 60 Minutes was that, hey, Powell's ready to start easing everything up, lowering rates. So the market was expecting, you wrote that, you did this, it was what, 99% chance of?
Yeah, there was a 99% chance that they were going to cut rates at the March meeting.
As early as last month. And now the market is not even close to that, because we keep getting this cotton candy, like higher, a little warmer, a little hotter, a little stickier than expected. And now the market is kind of in this. Maybe it's not a dip. It's not, they're not, the market's not depressed, but they're even more eager than ever to get a little bit of relief from the Fed. And that's, I think, where we stand today, waiting and watching. Hey, are they going to ever ease up? Are mom and dad going to go back on vacation? Is the candy bowl ever coming out again? And right now, it just doesn't look like that's coming anytime soon. Right now, the marketplace is only expecting two cuts. And I wouldn't be surprised if we had zero cuts by the end of the year. That's possible. And the question is, what does that mean for investors? First of all, you did some research around this, Jeff Lloyd. We mentioned it on the show, but it keeps the tally keeps moving here. The days in this state of I'm not raising, but I'm not lowering interest rates, call it the Fed pause. What happens to markets over that period of time?
Well, yeah, going back to, we look at 10 Fed pauses going back to 1974. And historically speaking, the longer the pause...
The last 50 years.
Yeah. The longer the pause, historically, the better equity returns.
So this is S&P 500 during rate cuts.
During Fed pauses. Yeah, Fed just pauses. When the Fed's pauses, which is what they're doing right now. Historically speaking, the longer the pause, the better the S&P equity returns. In periods where the pause is greater than 100 days, the market is up on average about 12 to 13%. When that pause is less than 100 days, the market average is actually down. So the market goes down if the rate cuts are less than 100 days. Or well, the pause is less than 100 pauses. Days.
And that's where we are. We're in the, 260 some odd days of this stalemate, if you will. And I think it also just makes people wonder, well, when is it going to happen? And that's why the fevered pitch continues. The tension continues to boil. When are we going to get a little bit of relief? When are rates going to go down? And the answer is we just don't know. It could be the entire – now, nobody's even talking about rate hikes. God forbid we talk about rate hikes. We're thinking that as long as we get a little bit more relief, which has proved to be really tough, right? The majority of the inflation problem was corrected over the course of about a year and a half or so. It just hasn't continued to get better because inflation has been pretty steady and not coming down. And that's happened now for several months. So the market is waiting for, and I think this still probably comes back to housing, because shelter in the latest CPI number accounted for 60% of the high inflation number, that 3.5%. If you take shelter out and make shelter flat as opposed to up 6% or 5.7% like it was in the last report, then you would actually see inflation in the 1.5% to 2.5% range. Now, that's in a vacuum. That's looking at one component, but it's a really big component. Jeremy Siegel a week or two ago pointed out, if you look at real-time data on Zillow or Apartment List, rental prices haven't gone up for a year. In fact, they're lower today than they were over a year ago. So at some point, you've got to think that comes in the inflation calculation and we get a little relief. If we get some relief, that means the Fed could actually start to put the candy bowl back out, lower rates a little bit, ease up on the spinach dinners. And I think here's the bottom line, is that the Fed is taking this very measured approach. They don't want inflation to reaccelerate. So they're sticking to this pause, and they're still saying they're going to ease into cuts. We're not going to cut anytime soon until we think it's a good idea and inflation is really behind us. So it's not, and I don't think it's the end of the world for the economy. This economy is doing really well. Nor is it a surefire win for the U.S. economy and the stock market if we do get cuts. We do know that historically, Jeff, as you just mentioned, the Fed takes a breather. When they take a breather like this, it's a pretty good place for stocks to be in that Fed holding pattern. So we're seeing solid growth right now, and it's not as though we need lower interest rates anytime soon. We'd like them, and if you're looking to buy a home and you like a lower mortgage rate, sure, we'd like them, but unemployment rate, we know that it's at 3.7%. CPI, 3.5%. Retail sales up almost 0.75% last month. State of the consumer, average hourly earnings increased to over almost $35 an hour. That's a 4% increase over the last 12 months. Housing market, median home price calming down. What looked like it was headed to 500,000. Meanwhile, it's kind of backed up a little bit. It's closer to 400, depending on what median home price data you look at. Redfin's a little different than the National Association of Realtors, but all around that 400 range. And then we've seen manufacturing pick up. The latest manufacturing number shows not contraction like we've seen for the last several months, but some expansion. So the economy's is on pretty solid ground. I'm not going to say it's an amazing economy, but it's tough to make the case that it's a bad economy. And that's a good thing for investors over time, whether the Fed cuts once or twice this year or not. How does setting the goal to have income for a lifetime sound? It's not a trick question. Many happy retirees create income for a lifetime, and it's something that's called income investing. It's a way to harness the power of many different forms of cash flow, including rent, royalties, dividends, distributions, and interest. If you'd like help with income investing, you can reach Capital Investment Advisors at yourwealth.com. That's yourwealth.com. Welcome back to Money Matters. Your host, Wes Moss, here along with Jeff Lloyd. And we've been very excited about FedWatch. There's been this obsession with the market and the media around mommy and daddy Fed. It's how strict are our economic parents going to be? And we had a long time when we had zero interest rates, meaning that the interest rates, their target was down to zero. I mentioned that I think I said that the rates got all the way down to sub 2% on the 10-year treasury. We looked it up during the break. How low did the 10-year Treasury?
The 10-year Treasury about 4 years ago got below 0.5%.
So people were getting paid less than 0.5% for a decade to then get their money back. That's it. When you get back to a more normal interest rate environment, where we are today, I would say is more historically more normal, 5.25 to 5.5. That's where the Fed has set their target rate, and that dictates where mortgage rates are. It's hard to even fathom that rates were that low. It seems kind of, this seems crazy. And remember, I remember doing many shows that were talking about negative interest rates, particularly in Europe. We had banks where you were paying to put your money in a bank. You weren't getting paid. That was when we had negative interest rates. It was something like $7 trillion worth of negative interest rate bearing accounts around the world or bonds. It hard to even imagine that. They didn't write that in the textbooks 20 years ago when you're studying the economy.
Well, we were joking during the break that doesn't even make sense. Like the 10-year at below 1%.
10-year government bonds.
Like that doesn't make any sense.
Right.
But when they're negative, it literally doesn't make any sense. You're not making money on it.
Oh, speaking of, that just reminded me of something economically that makes no sense. And you brought this up, and this has to do with coins. Americans, more than half the coins in the United States are half of all the pennies, nickels, quarters, dimes that have been manufactured in, I guess, a mint factory. More than half of all of the coins that are in the United States are sitting in a jar somewhere, or they're under the back seat, underneath the seat of your Tahoe somewhere.
Well, it's better sitting in a jar than a trash can, because you read this article and Americans throw away $68 million worth of coins each year.
$68 million just goes into the trash because people don't really like to use pennies anymore. Now, this was amazing to me, is that the cost to make a penny is more than a penny is worth. So if you look at the cost to make a penny, it costs almost 4 cents, 3.7 cents to make a 1 cent penny. So the government is losing 270% on that. Nickels cost, and a nickel, remind me, that's what, 5 cents, right? Costs almost 12 cents to make a nickel worth 5 cents. So that's a minus 131%. Dimes, fortunately, only cost about 5 cents.
Yeah, so when the U.S. Mint, when the U.S. Mint is making pennies and nickels, they're losing money.
Hey, we'll make it up in volume. We'll make it up in volume.
That's like business 101. That does not make sense.
What do Rocky the Mountain Lion, Harry the Hawk, and Benny the Bull all have in common, Jeff Lloyd?
They are all NBA mascots.
And
they all make more money in a year than Caitlin Clark is going to make over her four-year deal with the Indiana Fever. Just her base salary. Those three NBA mascots will make more in a year
than her entire contract, her four-year deal. So we know that she went number one. Again, we've talked about the Caitlin Clark effect. I think it's interesting. She's been fun to watch. When my kids are more excited to watch a Caitlin Clark play in NCAAs than the men's tournament and watching North Carolina, even though North Carolina got knocked out early. So I think that's part of it. It really does potentially change the game. We think of her as kind of the, maybe as Tiger Woods was to golf, she is to women's basketball. We'll see. You're a sports dad, and you brought some interesting research back from a volleyball tournament, I believe.
Yeah, we were in, you know, last week y'all talked about inflation at the Masters, or the lack of inflation
where inflation goes to die. Augusta
is where inflation goes to die. I was at a volleyball tournament and came across a menu and just could not believe the prices that I was paying.
Where were you guys in?
I was in Louisville, Kentucky for a volleyball tournament. It's a 3-day volleyball tournament. So we were there Thursday, Friday, Saturday, came back Sunday.
For your 14-year-old daughter. 14-year-old
daughter, and I just couldn't believe the prices I was paying for some of just regular items, especially after seeing all the items at Augusta. So to get a bottled water, it was $4. So that's twice the amount you were paying in Augusta.
That's true. It was $2.
You know, everyone talks about the sandwiches at Augusta, how good they are, but also how cheap they are. You know, you get a barbecue sandwich at the Masters for $3. At volleyball, $9. So I'm paying
$9 barbecue sandwich.
Three times as much for a barbecue sandwich. Coffee, double. I'm paying $4 for a burnt cup of coffee. Masters, $2. And then sweet tea, $5 at the volleyball tournament. That's $2 at the Masters, so I'm paying 2.5 times. So that's real personal inflation pain for me.
It is. And it's also youth sports. What's that doing? What is youth travel sports that we're a victim of doing to America? I don't know. We're both in the middle of that mix.
Hey, I love it. I had a great time. Not only am I paying, you know, more at the concession stands, I'm paying to drive up there or fly up there sometimes, pay for the hotel, pay for the ticket, pay for the ticket surcharge that the credit card processing company that controls all the tickets makes you pay. Maybe. There's like a 20% convenience fee to buy an online ticket for these tournaments.
Maybe in 20 more years, we'll be looking back and say, do you remember the era of travel sports? Because today we look back when we were kids, they didn't have all that. Well, it'll be interesting to see. Now, but let's go back to Caitlin Clark. She's going to make $338,000 over 4 years. That's according to the WNBA's collective bargaining agreement. So it's about 76 grand in the first year. It is kind of amazing. Steph Curry makes $50 million a year. He makes about, let's see here, he makes $50 million a year, or $1 million a week. Makes $1 million a week, 82 regular season games, getting paid about $630,000 per game, 160 grand per quarter of basketball. So he's making more in a quarter, really double what Caitlin Clark is making for the entire season. Now, of course, she's got all these other massive endorsement deals, right? Nike's making her own shoe. We've got State Farm. I think she hugged Jake from State Farm.
Yeah, the deal. We were watching the WNBA draft. Caitlin Clark gets picked, you know, comes from the crowd, goes up to the stage, takes a picture with the commissioner. While she's walking off, the first person that gives her a hug,
Jake
from State Farm.
And Gatorade. So Gatorade, State Farm, Panini, which sounds like a sandwich maker, but I think it's a trading card company. And then, of course, Nike. So she's going to be just fine. It is kind of interesting that the NBA mascots, Rocky, the mountain lion of the Denver Nuggets, makes $625,000 a year. That's the mascot. And Harry the Hawk makes $600,000. Again, these are mascots making quadruple what Caitlin Clark is making. Just interesting. She'll make it up in endorsements, of course, so nobody's feeling bad for her. Let's see, where do we go here, Jeff Lloyd? I think partially, not that this is brand new, but we've got tension. Can you believe we have tension in the Middle East? So we have another new flare-up in the Middle East. And every time this happens, of course, we always worry about what is next and how does this escalate? And we think about what happens to the world when it comes to these. I guess the nice way to say it is geopolitical tensions. The reality is we're talking about war. We're talking about things that scare us, that cost human life. They impact our whole entire lives, our families. And then, of course, the economy, the stock market, what does it do? Makes us scared and nervous, which is why investing is so hard, because there's always something bubbling up somewhere. And sometimes it goes very wrong and we end up in a real conflict or a real war. But the question is, what does that do to markets? And if you go back to the early 1900s, so the first one on our list here, if you're tracking, quote, geopolitical events, really are wars for the most part. You start with the Russia-Japan war back in 1904. The question is, what happens to markets a year after these conflicts or 6 months after these conflicts? World War I, then the escalation of World War I, the D-Day, Suez Canal, Berlin, the Berlin problem in 1961, the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Six-Day War. Again, this is a very long list here. And in some periods of time, a few months later, the markets are not good and they're not in great shape and they're down. But if you look out 6 months later, over 60% of the time, markets are positive on average, up about 4 to 5%. if we're giving it some time. And then a year later, almost three quarters of the time markets are positive. 12 months after, on average, 11.8, almost 12%. So as difficult as all of these periods are, and as scary as they are, because we don't know where they lead, do they get worse is always the question. It's always the boogeyman around the corner that's scarier than the boogeyman right in front of us. Question is, where does this go? We know historically over time, markets have been able to recover from these events. And that's the reality and the resiliency of markets. But you just, that worry, that human instinct that makes investing really hard is we don't know, we haven't lived through this one yet. It could be different this time. That's what investors say to themselves. And that's why you see these pullbacks. And markets have pulled back here a little bit over the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, and I think it's just a good reminder for the listeners out there. Certainly the human tragedy and an element through all these conflicts. We're just talking about taking a step back from that and taking a step back from the scary headlines that we've seen over the last couple of weeks and just looking from a market perspective, 3 years down the road, markets historically are positive on average after these events.
Before we talk about some of the ETFs that we wanted to at least talk through, again, we're not making recommendations here because everyone listening and maybe in a different spot, and what may be good for you may be not good for someone else. Everyone has different risk tolerance and time horizons. So when we talk about specific exchange traded funds as just these are examples to help educate things to be looking at. I don't know if they're right for you or not, but they're at least interesting to research and learn about. And I think that's part of the reason we like to bring up specific ideas to go research. In the meantime, I want to talk about fast food price inflation because there's a really cool study from, I found this on, or you found this, I think, on Finance Buzz, but it's a really comprehensive study from all the well-known fast food restaurants. Some of these I wouldn't say necessarily fast food, but I guess you could call them fast food. And just how dramatic the price increases have been. Because the reality is the reason we're investing to begin with, whether we're looking at dividend paying stocks or just the market in general, we're investing to be able to outpace inflation. So we have these geopolitical events that take us down and scare us in the moment. But then you have what I would consider just a really heavy weight on your back as you're running this marathon that's called investing and saving for retirement. It's just always there. It doesn't ever go away. And it weighs us down. The value of our dollars continue to, we call it wilt over time. We know over the course of economic history, a dollar is quickly worth 97 cents. And then it's very quickly worth 90 cents. And because it's only a couple percentage points per year, now last summer it was 9% a year inflation, imagine over the course of a decade just how much purchasing power we lose when it comes to those dollars in our wallet. If they're not invested and they're literally sitting there as actual physical dollars, they're wilting. Now, the reason behind that, of course, is inflation. Everything costs more. If your dollar's staying there, it's not keeping up, then it's worth less on a relative basis. And there is no better example than the last decade in fast food, because these are prices that we see on the, I don't know if you call it the screen or when you're ordering at a fast, what do we call that? You drive up, it's at the drive-through. The drive-through menu.
Yeah.
I guess you just call it the drive-through menu.
That.
Again, this is through, who did this study? Well.
Yeah, this was Finance Buzz.
Finance Buzz. Over the past 10 years. So we're going to 2014 to 2024. They point out that actual inflation, I think they're probably just using CPI here, is up a little over 30%. So they say 31%. I think it's a little more than that, but we'll take it for what they're saying. Every single restaurant that they studied has raised their menu prices more than that. So it's not just that we find companies stay in line. Companies often are outpacing inflation. So we looked at Subway and Starbucks, we looked at Arby's, we looked at, my eyes are, I can't see all these, Popeyes, Taco Bell, McDonald's, Burger King. And the prices of specific items are really incredible. If you look at the McDonald's McChicken, this is a sandwich, I believe, it is up over that 10-year period, 199%. Yeah, inflation's up 31. The McChicken is up almost 200%. The McDouble up 168%. Just, you know what? Medium fries, Jeff Lloyd, up 138%. All topping the list, by the way, that's all McDonald's. McDonald's is arguably the one with the, well, McDonald's clearly here has by far the most inflation, up about 100%. We'll go into some of the other restaurants as examples, but we're going to do a quick break. Then more Money Matters, fast food, inflation, straight ahead. Jeff Lloyd, so much fun when you're here. Not that it's like fun when Connor Miller's here too, but you're both, you guys are just both so good.
Just great. Bring a different energy, you know?
Protecting purchasing power. We were talking about fast food prices. The culprit, as you coined, is McFlation. Up about 100% over the past decade, if you're looking at the menu at McDonald's. The least bad when it comes to menu inflation, Starbucks and Subway, up only 39%, which is just a little above inflation. Some of our favorites, of course, right in the middle here, Chick-fil-A and Wendy's, right around that 50-55% level of inflation. But really, it's Popeyes and McDonald's that for some, it's Taco Bell, Popeyes, and McDonald's that have really taken it to the menu and just risen prices dramatically. And this is something that we wrote this week. You know, we know from history that one of the, not the only way, but one of the best ways to insulate ourselves against inflation and protect our purchasing power, going back 150 years, is that companies just in the S&P 500, have been able to grow their dividends at a rate that is nearly double the rate of inflation. Now, double the rate of inflation, that sounds a lot like what McDonald's doing. They're increasing their prices more than double the rate of inflation over the last 10 years, but that means that, and mathematically, inflation over that huge period of time is about 2% on average per year. Dividend growth is 3.7, not quite 4, not quite double, but substantially higher over time. That means, think of it this way, that in an average year, a basket of goods and services that cost $1,000 a year ago now costs $1,020. That's the inflation. It's 22% more. But a portfolio of dividend growth companies, or really just S&P 500 companies here, that yielded $1,000 a year ago would now yield $1,037. So things got $20 more expensive, but you get $37 more in order to do that. So dividend investors on average got, and this is over a long, long period of time, a real or inflation adjusted raise of about 1.7% per year. It's not, and that's not including the impact of price appreciation. We're just talking about the cash flow and the free cash flow in most cases and earnings that get distributed out from companies after they know what they're making in a given year. They set their dividend policy and they really try to stick to it. Case in point, as an example, we just got an announcement this week from Johnson & Johnson. That company has risen the dividend. They've cranked it just a little bit higher every single year now for the 62nd year in a row. So over six decades, 62 years in a row, they're paying out a little bit more per share, a little bit more per share. None of them sound like a whole lot. This one was what, Jeff? Was it 5 cents?
It was a 5 cent increase.
It's only 5 cents. Nobody cares. 5 cents, what's the big deal? Percentage basis.
Percentage wise, that's 4.2%. So that's outpacing inflation by 0.7%, because if you look at the year-over-year inflation print, that was 3.5%. J&J's dividend, 4.2%.
Very much in line with what we've seen over the course of history. You know, it's a little early in the day to be thinking about Taco Bell, but I can't help but smile as we look through this list of menu items that have increased. And this is where we see this. We know. The reason I think it's important is that you know a Big Mac. Now, I think McDonald's was smart to not overly inflate the price of the Big Mac, only up 50% over the last, call it, decade. But some of the other areas are not so good. The Quarter Pounder with Cheese meal went from $5, a little over $5, to about $12. That's a 122% increase. Medium fries up 138%, McDouble up 168%. That's why over the course of the last year, on average, the McDonald's menu is up 100%. Starbucks has kept their foot off the inflation pedal, only up 39%. Chick-fil-A, Arby's, Wendy's, kind of right there in the middle at 55%. But some of these Taco Bell items that I don't know who buys these. I feel like this is for college. I don't know who does this. Cheesy Gordita Crunch has doubled in price. $2.49 now at $5 today, or $4.99. The beefy five-layer burrito is up 132%. Have you eaten Taco Bell lately?
I have, and I have to say the cheesy gordita crunch is phenomenal. So, you know, I'm paying double what I paid 10 years ago. I'd probably even pay even more.
You'd go triple. You know, at Starbucks, I feel like for a decade ago, people were making fun of how expensive Starbucks was, and maybe that's why they have been really careful about this. So the mocha frappuccino is up only 32% in the past decade, and the chai tea latte is only up 30%. And if you notice, I feel like there's been a little less ire on Starbucks prices. It's maybe because they're arguably the lowest inflators on this list. They're the least culprit, if you will, on this list. Now, we do that to point out that there's only a few ways to keep up with inflation, and that is to invest in areas that inflate along with inflation. It's a pretty simple story if you think about it. And every one of these companies is an example of that. These are companies that are selling a product. It's getting more expensive, so they're raising their prices, and they're doing it beyond the rate of inflation. Hence, we see big companies are able to pass the cost along to the consumer, and a lot of times they get away with passing even more than they need to pass on as they are trying to increase their earnings over time. Hence, we go back to 1871 to 2024, we look at how dividends have done as far as growing in the S&P 500, and they have almost double the rate, dividend growth, almost about double the rate of what inflation has been over the course of over 100 years. So inflation has been about 2% per year if you go back 150 years. The rise in and how much companies have paid out, this is just the S&P 500 as a group, has been 3.7%. So not quite 4%, not quite double, but substantially above the rate of inflation. Even over the past 12 months, if you look at the numbers, we know that inflation has been 3.5%. That was the latest CPI report. Dividend growth has been 4.6%. So not a double, but it's still outpaced. Now, one of the things we said we talk about here today are just if we're looking for. So first of all, that's just the S&P 500. However, if you're looking for companies that specifically are able to raise or have been able to raise their dividend over time, there are ETFs that do the same thing or look for the same thing. And again, I'll couch this with the thought that it's hard here on an investment of money, a retirement show, we really can't make any recommendations to go buy or sell anything because everybody in the audience is different risk tolerance, time horizon, financial situation, tax bracket. There's a long list of variables that make everyone really unique. And that's why we can't say you should buy and sell any given security, ETF, mutual fund, stock, you name it. However, I think it's also important to be able to bring up some of these investments and learn from what they are trying to do. And then you go make a decision whether it's right for you and your particular situation. So a couple of areas, and we've talked about these over the last few years, but there are ETFs out there that try to only hold companies that are able to grow their dividend. One of my favorite charts of the year is going into, if you think about any financial application, whether it's Bloomberg or if you're on Apple stocks, you're going to see a chart. And it's always the chart of the stock price. What I love to do is pull up a chart of only the dividend. So if you're only looking at the dividend, I went and looked at some of the holdings in this first example, which is the Spider S&P 500 Dividend ETF, which is SDY. It's about 140 companies inside this one basket. So think of an ETF. ETF stands for Exchange Traded Fund. These are the evolution from mutual funds. Mutual funds, There's a daily price, closes at the end of the day. It's a basket of companies. ETF, very similar, except it's valued every second of the day. So the index, if you're looking at this SPDR S&P 500 Dividend ETF, it screens for companies that have consistently increased their dividend for at least 20 consecutive years. Or that's the pool they're looking at. And then it weights that by yield, et cetera. It's looking at the index it's looking at is the S&P High Yield Dividend Aristocrat Index. So that's where it comes from. And so this is a big index. This is similar to the S&P 1500 index. Again, looking for 20 years of consecutive increases. So if you go back and if you dig a little deeper, you'll find companies inside of that ETF. And again, about 140 of them. I pulled out about a half dozen: Exxon, Johnson & Johnson, IBM, AbbVie, Medtronic, Clorox, Lockheed Martin, Aflac. And I wanted to just test and double and triple check that, in fact, their dividends are going up over the course of time. And that's exactly what you'll find. Now, not in every single case do they go straight up, but in most cases here, if you're charting just the dividend, not talking about price here, just the amount that these companies pay out per share in any given year, they look like escalators. They look like a gentle set of stairs, if you will, going from, if you're looking at the chart, from the lower left to the upper right. Now, some are better than others. If you look through here, you can see Lockheed Martin, as an example, has been a formidable dividend increaser, whereas a company like Aflac, it's much more muted. But at the same time, the lines are going, the stairs are moving higher. And that's what this, as an example, this ETF is trying to do. Here's another example. This is the iShares Core Dividend Growth ETF. Now, this is a even more diversified with a slightly less stringent dividend policy here, where SDY is 20 years where the dividend increases. DGRO, which is the symbol for the iShares Core Dividend Growth ETF, the criteria here is just five. They want five, this particular ETF wants 5 years of uninterrupted annual dividend growth from, let's call it, a big universe of dividend growers. They also want to make sure that the dividend that gets paid out is not exceeding 75% of earnings. So this is another caveat around earnings and dividends. If a company earns $1 a share and it's paying out 90 cents per share, then it's giving back almost everything that it's making. And in some cases, that can be a little bit of that's a hard policy to do year after year after year, and also be able to increase the dividend. So it goes back to this Goldilocks concept. We don't want the very highest dividend yielders. We don't want the lowest either. So we want some that are, to some extent, kind of right in the middle. So then they narrow that universe down, and they also want to make sure the dividend yields are not in the top 10% of the universe. So you don't necessarily want the very highest payers either. A lot of times you can run into problems. If you have a stock that's paying 8% or 12% a year, that's just very often not sustainable for the most part. So we're looking for somewhere in that Goldilocks, not too hot or not too high, not too low, when it comes to the dividend policy. Some of these same companies, so Exxon is an example, Microsoft, Chevron, JP Morgan, Apple. So you've got some technology names, you have banking names, you have energy names. Procter & Gamble is one, Home Depot. Those are all examples of some of the holdings inside of an ETF like the iShares Core Dividend Growth ETF. So these are examples that, as you dig down a little deeper, we know the overarching goal of the ETF, only hold dividend growers over time. And then we can dive in a little bit deeper and see what they actually hold. And that's where you can start to get a little comfort, a little more knowledge around what you're actually owning.
Yeah,
makes sense, Jeff.
Yeah, and you highlighted the company diversification, and I know you talked about it a little bit, but within these ETFs, you get broad. In some of these ETFs, you get broad sector exposure. You get the financials, you get healthcare, tech, energy, utilities, all in the same ETF, but across a broad spectrum of companies.
Well, and you don't really think about technology companies paying dividends, but over the last decade or so, we've seen more and more of that happen. So in the case of DGRO, as an example, the iShares Core Dividend Growth ETF, 17% of the companies inside there are within technology. They're in the tech space. We have, as you maybe would expect, 16% of the companies are healthcare, a little bit more known for paying dividends. 7% are utilities. They're well known for paying dividends over time. Of course, banks, part of that 18% are financials. But again, you've got lots of different sectors here that are contributing to that grouping of companies that this particular ETF is looking for and trying to hold, and screening for companies that have been able to raise the dividend for 5 consecutive years. Now, it's not necessarily an exact hard and fast, so there's usually some exceptions, particularly when you have that many companies in an ETF. You'll even find some exceptions in the SPDR S&P dividend ETF where they may not have raised consecutively, but the trend is certainly higher. So it's not an exacting rule, but the parameters are very clear of what they're trying to do. And again, for investors looking for cash flow, depending on the cycle you're in and the stage you're in when it comes to your retirement planning, whether you're pre-retirement, on the verge of retirement, or well into retirement, we have different goals at different time periods. So this is something for folks looking for current income potentially. And it's something I think at least worth looking into, getting a little bit more information about. Again, I can't say it's right for you or not, but certainly something interesting here as we're talking about dividends and dividend growth, so we can buy our favorite fast food and combat, as Jeff Lloyd calls it, Mickflation. Can't believe we're wrapping up already, Jeff Lloyd. We started out today saying that we had a nice email from a listener through our website, Your Wealth, yourwealth.com, and said, I feel like I learned something when I listen to Money Matters. So I wanted to really remember that today and double down on making sure we're helping people learn something here on a Sunday morning. We appreciate people tuning in.
Yeah, and that's not patting ourselves on the back. It's just a nice reminder.
It is a little bit. It's just a little bit.
Just a nice reminder to us and our listeners. Like, we want them to learn from this show week in and week out.
I think that I like to use here today. We talked about fast food inflation. It's I think it's easy for us to wrap our heads around menu prices that we know that we've seen, and if they double over time, that's a really good example of inflation. Dividends is an example, one of the tools in our toolbox in order to protect our purchasing power. We talked about how the market's obsession with mommy and daddy fed, meaning that it's almost as though parents were out of the house for about 7 years. If you go back to 08 all the way through 2015, the Fed kept interest rates they literally were at 0%. Mallory, through the break, was like, wait a minute, zero? Wait, how could it be zero? So soon we forget of how crazy interest rate policy was. It was all candy, all easy, all low rates. We could do whatever we wanted. Money was, quote, free. And then here we are over the last, call it, year and a half, and it's all spinach. And mom and dad are home. The house was a mess. So they've employed the strictest of policies. You're all grounded. We're raising rates. No iPhones for you. And we're all sitting there with bated breath waiting for mom and dad just to calm down and go back on vacation. Hey, can you lower rates a little bit? Do we have to eat spinach for every meal? And that's where we are. And I think that's why the market is so obsessed with this. Doesn't seem like we are going to have a whole lot of easing of interest rates. And guess what? It's okay. This economy and the stock market can still do fine. Now, if the 10-year treasury rate goes all the way up to 5% and it's starting to approach that, sure, I think it's a tougher road for stocks for a little while. But we've lived through the course of economic history with rates in the 5 and 5.5% range for many periods of time. And guess what? The economy did just fine. So it's not as though we can't get through that. It's not the end of the world if the Fed doesn't cut 3 times this year. They may cut zero, And I think this economy will still be okay. The market won't like it as much, but it doesn't mean that companies still can't earn, grow earnings, et cetera. So I don't look at this as this obsessed Fed watch and are they going to cut or not? I think the reality here is we have a pretty good economy. And that's really what I care about. And whether we cut or not, this economy is in pretty decent shape, Jeff Lloyd.
No, it is. And just a reminder, if the Fed doesn't cut, the economy should be doing just fine.
That's a great point. That means that things are still on a trajectory that's strong, and they feel like they don't want to juice the economy by lowering rates. So it's, if I had to choose one of the two, I'd choose the no cuts. It means the economy is still moving in the direction we would all like to see, and I think that's really what investors want, at least over time.
This is provided as a resource for informational purposes and is not to be viewed as investment advice or recommendations. This information is being presented without consideration of the investment objectives, risk tolerance, or financial circumstances of any specific investor and might not be suitable for all investors. The mention of any company is provided to you for informational purposes and as an example only and is not to be considered investment advice or recommendation or an endorsement of any particular company. Past performance is not indicative of future results. Investing involves risk, including possible loss of principal. There is no guarantee offered that investment return, yield, or performance will be achieved. The information provided is strictly an opinion and for informational purposes only, and it is not known whether the strategies will be successful. There are many aspects and criteria that must be examined and considered before investing. This information is not intended to and should not form a primary basis for any investment decision that you may make. Always consult your own legal, tax, or investment advisor before making any investment, tax, estate, or financial planning considerations or decisions. Investment decisions should not be made solely based on information contained herein.